Hi, everyone. This is the On Science podcast from NPR News. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer at the Science Desk here. The Science Desk has been covering the ongoing nuclear disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan. And I'm joined in the studio this week by correspondents Christopher Joyce and Richard Harris, both of whom are back from 2 weeks of reporting in Japan. Hi to you both.
Hi.
Hello. Glad to be back.
How was the trip?
Interesting. Actually, Richard got there a day before me, and then we were tag-teaming this story, I guess, night shift, day shift, for a solid week and a half anyway. I can't say we were up close and personal with this accident since we were 140 miles away in Tokyo, but that's where a lot of the, that's where you got information from the government and from TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company. That's where their headquarters are, and that's where they had press conferences and about every day, several times a day.
Yeah, and I did get up to the, a little bit towards the reactor. I went up to the Ibaraki Prefecture, which is where a small amount of radioactive dust had landed on spinach and other vegetables. And as a result of that, they banned the sale of spinach from this prefecture and upset quite a number of farmers who obviously lost their livelihoods. The government said that they would reimburse them eventually, but of course that's something that will have to get worked out over the course of quite a length of time. But it was interesting for me and a producer to go up there. Jane Greenhalgh came with me, and we did a story about a spinach farmer who had essentially lost his entire crop.
So what do we actually know about what's going on at the nuclear reactor? It's sort of been a couple steps forward, a couple steps backward. It's sort of good news, bad news. What's the status of, I know it's going to change day by day, but right now, what are we looking at?
Right now, I would say things are fairly stable. They're not in great shape because the reactors still are not really completely shut down, and they're still fighting to basically get rid of a large pool of radioactive water that's sitting in various trenches and tunnels and pools in the basements and elsewhere in the reactors, and that's really hampering their ability to get in and actually finish what they started. So that's the main thing. It seems at this point, when Chris and I first got there, there were a series of explosions and hydrogen releases and a couple of large belches of radiation that went off, some into the ocean, some onto land. We've not seen anything like that since about March 16th, when that was the last of those big events, and it's quite possible we won't.
Yeah, a lot of what we're seeing now in the, what you might call the mid-stage, the mid-game, if you will, about this is, as Richard said, stable. I think of it as sort of being on a razor's edge. It's stable, but it could fall one way or the other. What we're hearing are kind of the sequelae, if you will, of the accident, in that they're not explosions anymore, and the cores seem to be stable for the moment. But all the water that they poured onto the reactors and into the spent fuel pools, desperately trying to keep them cool, those have, in a sense, come home to roost, because the water is now very radioactive, as well as water that probably came out of their cores, and nowhere for it to go except down in the basement or out into the ocean. So now they're seeing these elevated levels on site, but off site, things seem to be reasonably stable too.
That's kind of been the theme here. At the beginning, they started pumping water in, first fresh water, and then they ran out of fresh water, and then they started turning to salt water and pumping salt water in, and now it's becoming problematic itself. They've been dumping it on top of the buildings. It's sort of filling up basements and trenches and tunnels, and even filling up all the places for it to go to store it. So what are they going to be doing? It seems like they can't get much recovery out and work on it until they get the water out and off the plant.
Yeah, and they are struggling with that right now. They're back to pumping in fresh water again, by and large. So they brought in a fresh supply, and they got some pumps operating that allowed them to do that. So at least they're not dealing with salt water anymore. But yeah, they have they're pumping some of it into holding tanks, but they're going to run out of holding tanks. And they're not really sure exactly what it is they want to do with it. Because, the worst case is it just sits there and they can't work on the plant until the radioactivity cools down. I think what's likely to happen is more of it is likely to find its way into the ocean, which is not a environmentally really great solution. But on the other hand, if you have to weigh the fact that it will dilute quickly in the ocean water against the fact that you're also going to be in a position where, until you get rid of the water, you can't really get in and finish the work that needs to be done to, put this thing really into a much more stable condition. So, well, I think that's the question for next week, is what they are going to do. They've been calling in some international experts to seek their advice and counsel, but It's a good question.
You know, with the seawater, I'm reminded of that the term that toxicologists sometimes use is a solution is dilution. It's a big ocean, and so eventually it's going to be diluted, and of course it will decay on its own. But part of the problem is attitude, and it's concern and fear, the economic problems that come from people saying, well, you know, I just don't want to buy any seafood from Japan, period. Regardless of where it comes from in Japan, I mean, there's plenty of parts of Japan that are fine. But even I was over at the fish market, the largest fish market in the world in Tokyo, and talking to some people who were in the fish business, and they said, you know, we get people in asking us, you know, is it safe to buy fish? And they've actually gone to the point where they have maps showing where the fish came from that they're selling, and with a big arrow saying, no, it's down here, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away from where the plants are. So, you know, there's a public perception problem that is and will continue to hurt Japan economically.
Now, you guys were both in Tokyo for most of the time that you were in Japan, and I know that when we, back here in D.C., were watching the developments, it was sort of, the news was coming out in fits and spurts. How open was TEPCO, and or has government information been in sort of being able to report on what's going on there? Have you come across any challenges that you haven't come across in reporting the story?
Well, language at first.
Yeah, I mean, language is tough.
It's a huge problem with language. I mean, you know, without knowing the language, it's hard for me to assess, you know, do I think this guy's pulling the wool over my eyes or not?
Yeah, and the other issue for us was that there were multiple sources of information, and they didn't all agree with each other all the time. TEPCO sometimes said one thing, and the government's nuclear agency said a second thing, and the spokesman for the overall government might say something a little bit different. And so for us, it was partly a matter of filtering through and trying to understand where the truth lay in that. I think it was interesting that there was a fair amount of information that came out. Interesting contrast with sort of the Gulf oil spill, where the information was coming out from a single source, so you didn't have any confusion about it. That was the particular frontline person for the federal government. But it was coming out in the form of an eyedropper, essentially. So it was very little information, but it didn't necessarily contradict itself unless the spokesman contradicted himself from something he said a previous day. But so it was a different information problem than we confronted when we were covering the Gulf oil spill last year.
I mentioned that to you, Chris, earlier this week, and you sort of soundly rejected it and said that this isn't really at all like the BP oil spill.
Well, I mean, in the sense of the kind of accident that it was. I mean, the BP oil spill, this is a natural disaster. I was talking about the sort of the way it came upon the Japanese. And whereas, in a sense, the BP oil spill was a disaster of human error in engineering. I suppose in the end, people could say this was error on the Japanese part. But frankly, these plants were designed to withstand something less than they experienced. And you can argue that the plants actually did survive. And at this point, you can say that they've managed to hold this thing and contain it maybe as well as anybody could under the circumstances. But I think eventually, like all of these nuclear accidents, it's going to take a long time and a lot of reexamination before you get it, you know, mistakes made, what they could have done. You know, there's always hindsight, but it takes a long time to sort out. I mean, when Richard was talking about getting different stories from different people, in a sense, that's kind of good, I think, in this, because you can double-check things against different sources. If you're getting it all out of an eyedropper, it's, to my mind, quite controlled. I got the sense that in Japan, there are two things that seem to be a little different. Their culture is different from ours, and there is a sort of a different level of consideration toward the government there than there is here. I saw no demonstrations in the street there for the first 2 weeks against nuclear power, which I would have expected if there had been an accident here. They just have a less flamboyant way of describing things, and it sort of felt like there was a lid on things, but it may be a cultural, and rather than simply trying to keep people from knowing the truth.
And I think the other thing that played into that was the government, knowing the culture, was able to stand up and say, we're finding radiation, you know, elevated radiation levels here and there, whatever. And most of the time they say it's not of a health concern. And I think the public would accept that at face value and say, okay, it's not a health concern. And I think many health physicists in America would say the same thing. But I think the American public just cannot get past the idea that any amount of radiation is a health concern. And I think the Japanese had a very different attitude and were much more willing to listen to the experts who said, you know, don't worry. Except that, I mean, there were a couple of occasions where they said, now it is a beyond the level of concern and we should take some actions to deal with it. And people said, okay, we'll take those actions. But it was a very, very different cultural background in which this took place.
And one slight observation just to advance that is that a lot of people I talked to said, look, you know, the tsunami has killed maybe 20, 25, 27,000 people. And so, you know, that's a much more serious and lamentable situation. And we're in mourning, if not actually, you know, burying our own relatives. This nuclear accident is almost secondary to the vast, horrible effects of the tsunami. You know, whereas Americans, they're not experiencing the tsunami, and they're thinking nuclear. And for the Japanese, it's like, you know, let's keep things in perspective here.
All right. Well, thank you both for coming in. I appreciate it, and keep up the good work. It's been great to hear all of your reports from afar.
Thanks.
Thanks very much.
We'll finish up the podcast this week with two stories we heard on air. One way to reduce your heating and air conditioning bills, and to get rid of that noisy air handler in your yard, is to install geothermal heat pumps. They use the constant mild temperature underground to heat and cool homes with much less electricity. And NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports that geothermal heat pumps are becoming more popular, thanks to a big tax credit.
Susie and James Bryant started thinking about going geothermal after their first winter in their house. It came with a rumbly 50-year-old oil furnace in the basement.
We looked at the $2,000 heating bill last year. We're like, oh, do I want to sink another $2,000 into this winter? So I was like, no.
Susie Bryant says if that wasn't enough to convince them, their aging air conditioner just wasn't keeping up.
Last year, our house kind of sat at 80 with the crazy summer we had.
With two toddlers and a baby, there are lots of demands for the Bryant's income. Susie Bryant is an electrical engineer turned stay-at-home mom, and her husband is a software engineer. They did a lot of research and number crunching before they decided to take the geothermal plunge.
We looked into it, and our payoff was about, you know, 3 to 7 years, so it kind of just made sense.
So for a few days this winter, their 1,900-square-foot house in Northern Virginia became a construction zone. The Bryants are among a growing group of homeowners replacing conventional furnaces and air conditioners with geothermal heat pumps. Geothermal systems started getting more popular several years ago, but mostly for new construction. The high initial costs of the systems could be wrapped into mortgages. 2 years ago, the federal government started offering 30% tax credits to entice people to install the systems. Some local and state governments offer tax breaks, too. They hope to cut greenhouse gas emissions and create green jobs.
That's a downhole hammer, actually drilling frozen ground.
Mike Barlow has been installing geothermal systems for 20 years.
It used to be primarily the bigger homes. Now it's gotten down to where it's townhomes, small homes. We've done 1,000-square-foot homes to 40, 50,000-square-foot homes. Anybody can really afford it.
At a house near Baltimore, Maryland, Barlow watches his crew drill boreholes. They use a powerful rig to dig 35 stories into the earth. When the drilling is done, Barlow's team pushes hundreds of feet of black piping into the hole. It's called a loop.
We circulate water down one side of the loop and back up the other side, and that's where we get our heat exchange.
The water from this loop and three others will be sent to a heat pump inside the house. The system takes advantage of the fact that the temperature underground stays constant year-round. In this part of Maryland, it's about 56.5 degrees.
What you do is you capture that 56.5 in the wintertime, and you use that to heat the home. It takes very little energy to complement that.
And bring your house to a comfortable temperature. Traditional air source heat pumps have to work a lot harder. In winter, they have to suck what heat there is out of, say, 30-degree air. In summer, they have to cool outdoor air from, say, 90 degrees. Barlow says the basic technology is so simple that even cavemen figured it out.
Basically doing what they did by staying in a cave in the winter to stay warm, and they stayed in the cave in the summer to stay cool.
Barlow says saving money isn't the only reason to do it.
It's a very good way of having green energy, so it'll help generations to come as far as their dependence on fossil fuel and just the protection of the planet in general.
Despite the lofty benefits and the smaller electric bills, geothermal systems make up only about 1% of heating and cooling systems sold each year. They're not nearly as well known as solar panels, but the two technologies have something in common. Their initial price tags chase lots of people away. Back at the Bryant's house, Jim Keeser is crouching under the basement stairs. He's flushing water through the new geothermal heat pump. I ask him what his other clients think of their systems.
The initial cost is a shock, but they love it. I haven't had any complaints.
Do you have it?
I wish I could afford it.
The Bryant's expect to spend about $20,000, but they did everything they could to keep costs down. They even rented a backhoe to dig trenches for the loops themselves. Susie Bryant says they're thinking about the future.
Don't you have to? With three little kids, I think that's the only way to think. Save money, right? Plus the tax credit doesn't hurt.
I checked in with the Bryants after they'd had their geothermal system for a couple months. They say it took a while to get the bugs out, but now it works perfectly. Their yard is still a mess, but they'll be planting grass soon. And they're already cashing in. They spent only about $100 a month to heat their house in January and February. That's just a fraction of the $600 a month they spent last year with their old furnace. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
And finally, biologists who study ecosystems typically look at the landscape as a whole to understand how each plant and animal fits in. But they don't generally listen to the landscape. Now, a group of scientists is calling for the creation of a new field of study to do just that. Richard Harris reports that they call this new field soundscape ecology.
There's nothing new about studying animal sounds. Biologists have been doing that for centuries. After all, if you want to understand birds like these in Madagascar, you need to understand how they communicate with sound. But Brian Pijanowski is now asking his colleagues to take a huge step back and, metaphorically speaking, listen not just to the trees, but to the forest.
We're trying to understand how sounds can be used as measures of ecosystem health.
He and some colleagues have written a call to action in the journal Bioscience. It's time, they say, to formalize the study of soundscape ecology.
So we're interested in kind of like all the voices of the landscape. Not just particular individual species, but really the orchestration of those different sounds by biological organisms.
Pijanowski has a few examples to make his point. Listen to this.
So we're listening to forest elephants at about 3 o'clock in the morning in the middle of the Congo. But we're also hearing some other sounds. The crickets and occasional birds and maybe some other things that are in the background here.
This recording shows, among other things, how animals divide up the soundscape. Insects are monopolizing the high frequencies, and elephants are commanding the low notes. Pijanowski says this sound is just as important to the environment there as the trees and the ponds. Okay, here's another example from his study.
So what we're listening to here is stridulation patterns from ants.
Stridulation is a fancy way of saying that ants are rubbing their body parts together to make sounds that they use to communicate. If you've never heard the sound, it's probably because you've never been buried inside an ant mound.
One of the main points that we're trying to make here is that a soundscape can be something that we humans just don't hear. It can be at a fairly small scale.
One goal of this research is to understand those soundscapes, how animals interact with each other and even across species. For example, some silent newts follow frog sounds to find the best breeding ponds. But one of the biggest questions confronting the field is figuring out how human beings affect the soundscape. Pijanowski made this recording near Purdue University. The high-pitched sound is from a soaring insect eater called a nighthawk.
It's flying overhead, and we hear these a lot in kind of small towns in the Midwest. And so they kind of help give us a sense of place. But we also have a church bell in the background, and that is something that we all kind of like. It's a cultural soundscape. But there are other sounds there that we don't find all that attractive and pleasing.
Like traffic. Those sounds may not be disturbing the nighthawk, but some bird species do poorly when nesting near the thrum of tires. And Jesse Barber at Boise State says scientists have just begun to explore how noise affects animals.
Probably the most telling work has come from a series of groups that have worked in oil and gas fields.
They compared bird life around noisy equipment that compresses natural gas with similar but quiet habitat. In Alberta, Barber says, they found birds had fewer offspring at the noisy sites. Similar results came from the southwestern United States.
The group working in New Mexico found that there's significantly reduced species richness comparing these two sites.
Lab experiments in Germany found that noise interferes with bats that hunt for insects on the ground by listening for the sounds they make when scurrying around. Barber says people just don't think much about how noise is affecting wildlife.
For instance, most land management agencies don't consider noise when they're making decisions about how to manage public resources. And even biologists, on the more basic level, haven't thought about how it's all integrated.
Barber has been part of a project to understand how noise is affecting national parks. He says there's been a huge change in the past few decades, as both vehicle traffic and airplane traffic have just about tripled in the U.S.
For instance, if you record in the backcountry of Yosemite, you'll find that 70% of the time a high-flying jet can be heard on the recording.
He suspects that low rumble is probably not bothering most animals, but still.
Even if it's not affecting wildlife, I would say that 70% of the time occupied by high-flying jets is definitely an influence to human enjoyment of that landscape.
So Barber agrees it's time to study the ecology of sound and find out how it affects people and wildlife alike. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And that wraps up the podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. You can find all of NPR's coverage from Japan, including recovery efforts and scenes from up and down the coast of the island nation, online at npr.org. And shoot us an email, sciencepodcast@npr.org. Let us know what you think of the podcast. We're eager for feedback. I'm Andrew Prince. We'll have more stories and conversations from the NPR Science Desk next week. Yeah.